Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio today, Ben Steelman of the Star News and Tony Rivenbark of the Thalian Hall Center for the Performing Arts. We're exploring this area's local history through the swamps and gardens, and if you've always wondered about some aspect of the Cape Fear region's history, now is your chance to ask about it. You can call us at 910-343-1138, email us at coastline@whqr.org, or tweet us using CoastlineHQ. And just before we went to break, I read an email from George Thomas, who is from Wilmington, and he says, less reported is the fact that many in the southern states opposed secession, pockets of resistance throughout North Carolina. Any of that resistance in Wilmington? Ben Steelman.
Not as much as in the western part of North Carolina when there were fewer slaves, but there were little flashes. There was a sort of secretive organization called the Heroes of America. And William Henry Chase Whiting was convinced that these people had infiltrated the salt works on the coast and were like signaling to the Union ships in the blockade off the coast and everything. But it was not very. There was not very much other than that. There was a pretty lively debate over secession in Wilmington before the state went out in 1861. George Davis, the guy whose statue is at 3rd and Market Street, was a member of a commission that went up to Washington early in 1861 in an effort to paper over the differences and get a reconciliation. But basically, when Fort Sumter fell and Abraham Lincoln issued his call to the states for troops, that pretty much decided most white North Carolinians, and North Carolina went out on May 20th, 1861, which was supposed to be the anniversary of the famed Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. Of course, black North Carolinians were not consulted on this.
Of course. And another important local historical site in the Civil War was the Moore's Creek Battleground. What happened there?
That's revolutionary.
That's revolutionary. So,
thank you. Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we talk about sites, we think of Thalian Hall as an important Civil War site because it was the center of entertainment in that period. And Wilmington, with 2,000 blockade ships coming in, most of the people sat around and waited for a ship to come in. There was nothing else to do but party. And this was the party town in the South, and one of the things people did was go to the theater. And from January 1864 to January 1865, there were over 300 different productions in Thalian Hall. That's how busy theater was because people had nothing to do while they were waiting for these blockade runners to come in.
Wilmington was a Civil War boom town. Most of the old residents moved out or moved inland for safety, but there are all these speculators, all these people who are getting stuff imported on the blockade runners. There are all of these young Royal Navy officers on reserve or half pay who are commanding or acting as officers on these blockade runners, and basically they were behaving like sailors in a port. There's a famous letter, it's in one of Dr. Andrew Howell's books, recounting a witness seeing a Royal Navy officer in fox hunting scarlets riding on the back of a poor Wilmington constable and whipping him with his riding crop. It was just terrible.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about southeastern North Carolina's history. What's rumor and what's fact? We have a couple of crack historians here to answer your questions. Tony Rivenbark, Executive Director of Thalian Hall Center for the Performing Arts and author of Images of America, Thalian Hall, and Ben Steelman, Star News staff reporter, columnist, and host of Prologue. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Daryl from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm not originally from Wilmington, and I've heard a lot of stories about maybe 100 years ago, a lot of black people were killed, land was taken. I don't know the whole story. I just like to hear the story.
Daryl, that's an excellent question, and we'll let Ben Steelman start with the coup d'etat of 1898.
That's right. Uh, Actually, Wilmington was from 1865 till 1898 was a pretty good place to live for African Americans. They sort of held a political balance of power. They were able to get a lot of local offices, particularly when they went into when the local Republicans went into to coalition with the populists. There were aldermen, policemen, all sorts of people, and of course there was a thriving African American newspaper edited by Mr. Alex Manly. But in 1898, the Democratic Party worked hard to take over the town, having lost control. The powers that be wanted to get control of the tax power again, and after a really mean election where people called red shirts, who were wearing red shirts, were riding around and intimidating African American voters at the polls. There was an ultimatum for all of the local officers to quit. An armed mob basically burned down Alex Manley's newspaper office and then went wild in town. At one point, several members of the local militia company were riding around with a Gatling gun on a wagon, shooting into buildings. Now, you sometimes hear that the Cape Fear River ran red with blood. That seems to go back to a rather intemperate comment by Alfred Moore Waddell, who became the new Democratic white mayor of Wilmington after the riot, who said that if no one cooperated, the river would run red with blood. Now, how many people died? That is still a mystery. It might have been as lowball estimates are 10. You see other estimates like 20 to 25, but there might have been more that were hidden or not reported. We just don't know. The fact is that a number of black and white Republican leaders were basically read out of town on the rail, escorted down on the to the railroad station, and put on the first train north. Thousands of other African American citizens headed into the woods and eventually left the city. The population actually dipped quite a bit after 1898.
And just to be clear about the landscape here, before that event, it was fairly progressive in terms of the rest of the United States, wasn't it?
New Hanover County was electing African Americans to the state legislature.
And when you say forced officers out, you're talking about elected officials.
Yes.
Tony Rivenbart.
Not too long ago, a couple of years ago, there was a documentary done about that, and they wanted to film it in the ballroom of City Hall. Well, that was not where the city council met. The city council has only been meeting in the second floor of City Hall since 1990. They never met on the second floor. Where they met is what is now the city manager's office. That was the mayor's court, and that's where the elected officials met from the Civil War period until the 1940s. So when the aldermen, the group of aldermen, were sitting down and the Waddell and that crowd came in and said, "You have to resign," out on the streets were filled with armed people to essentially enforce that will. And they could see it from that window. You can't see 3rd Street from the ballroom if you're sitting at a desk, but you can from Sterling Cheatham's office. You could see that. And so they changed. They shot the film downstairs so that you could see that crowd of people. But it would have been quite evident, and evidently was a very intimidating force of all these armed people, and every one of the aldermen resigned. And that was one of the most one of the few examples of a armed coup d'etat that held and was not treated and was not disciplined in any way by the government.
Is it true?
History.
Yeah, that is
history.
The only coup d'etat that we know of in American.
Some people say that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of other instances of something similar to that, but this was very specific.
And
the collector of ports of customs was a major federal position at that point, and that was an African American.
Right.
And we know that the elected officials were forced out. That's pretty well documented.
Oh, it's absolutely documented.
What about the loss of wealth and land for local residents, people who were African American, who were forced out of their homes?
I think that gets a lot fuzzier.
It does. Some people, a lot of people like Alex Manley moved north and maybe—
Alex Manley, the publisher,
of the
newspaper.
And they lost their material. Others others sort of hung on as long as they weren't a threat to anybody. The fact is, of course, that Wilmington's economy needed black labor to work. So, I mean, I've always sort of felt like 1898 wasn't like a massacre. It was more like a botched lobotomy or attempted a lobotomy. They were trying to eliminate the black middle class.
And they succeeded?
To a great extent.
You know, there were certain families that continued to stay on and still on to this day.
Like
but
the Sadge
a lot of people
for
left.
Example.
Yeah. And Manley was, interestingly enough, was actually a descendant of a former white governor, which I find also very interesting.
Yes.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about some of the local history in southeastern North Carolina with Tony Rivenbark of Thalian Hall and Ben Steelman of the Star News. We have an email from Sam who says, I've heard all my life that there was at one point tunnels used downtown to move supplies and slaves under to the river. Is there any truth to this story?
There are a lot of brick-lined tunnels dating from the late 1700s and early 1800s. The most famous being Jacob's Run, which runs under the Bricks Nightclub and all the way up to St. James Church. Father Abrams once showed me a little doorway where you can open up and get in there. The sad fact, though, seems to be that these were sewers, and though you get all sorts of great romantic stories that pirates hid booty in there or that the Underground Railroad smuggled slaves out through there or anything. Doesn't seem to be much evidence for that.
Jacob's Run actually starts up there above what used to be the law enforcement center. Mm-hmm. And it runs down. And when you look at the old courthouse, you see how low the right side is between that and the judicial building. It's really very low. You go way down to the ground. Well, that was a stream, basically, that ran down. Eventually, they bricked up that all the way down so they could build streets and things. Because downtown, you know, Wilmington is built on a bluff that was a very hilly area. There were seven large hills. Bill Reeves referred to it as the seven sand dunes of Wilmington, like the seven hills of Rome. And gradually over the years, it was trying to level this off for building. So you had this tremendous disparity between height and low. Thalian Hall stands on one of those hills, and the bottom of that hill is on the other side of the courthouse. And evidently at one point on 3rd Street actually was a bridge across 2nd. It was that low-lying area. But gradually over the years, it sort of smoothed it off.
And Tony Rivenbark, I want to ask you about Thalian Hall in a second, when it was built and why. But first, we have a note here. I guess Nick from Leland called and said he just left this message, wants to thank Tony Rivenbark for being so frank in discussing the Civil War. He says, you still hear comments that are discriminatory towards Yankees, and there's still a North-South divide.
Yeah, there is.
So Thalian Hall, when was it built, and why did local leaders decide that this community could support a theater of that
size?
Well,
first of all, it had a theater right there where Thalian Hall stands for 50 years, so it wasn't a new idea. But the city had grown. The city was the largest city in the state. The city government was operating out of rented space on Princess Street. The courthouse had moved from the center of Front and Market to the corner of Princess and 3rd, not where the courthouse is now, but the one where that new bank building, that's where the courthouse was. So the city, operating out of rented space, wanted a new seat of government, and they began to eye the property directly across the street where the old Ennis Academy stood, which was a school that had a theater in it. And the school was no longer in operation. And at the back was another school called the Oddfellow School, which wasn't torn down until 1925. So the Antebellum Thalian Association The fourth group of that name had been organized in 1846-47, and they were using the theater. But for years, the Wilmington papers had talked about the need for a proper theater. And theaters in those days, not in, particularly in provincial towns, did not just serve drama. They were the assembly room. They were the convention center where you could have big events, even political rallies, because you didn't have the media that we're talking on. If you're making a political speech, you need a room with enough people to come in to help support your cause. So
Frederick Douglass lectured there
right,
at one point.
Yes, he did. Yeah. And then there was also another group that were interested in a library. So, and then the Home Guard, which was sort of the National Guard of the day, the Wilmington Light Infantry and the Cape Fear Guards, they needed a place to store their armaments. So all these forces came together, which is why this massive building. It's almost if they decided we really want a grand building. So now let's think of all the things we can put in it.
Ben Steelman.
Well, see, this is happening in the 1850s, which were really flush times for Wilmington. The town was making a lot of money off of what were called naval stores, tar, pitch, and turpentine, which you needed back in the days when ships were wooden. There was a lot of rice culture coming out of the plantations like Orton and Belvedere on the Cape Fear River. Not so much cotton, not so much tobacco. That would come later. But the town was prospering. It had gotten up to the incredible size of slightly less than 10,000 people by the 1860 census. That made it, oddly enough, the largest town in the state of North Carolina, and it would remain that way into the 20th century. And all of a sudden, you have all these public buildings going up. Dr. John D. Bellamy builds his gorgeous house on Fifth Avenue about this time. He brings in Rufus Brunel, a Vermont architect, to do the work. And First Baptist Church raises a brand new building right across the street from Bellamy Mansion with this enormous steeple that was apparently at one point the tallest steeple in North America, at least very briefly. Of course, this is the steeple that fell down in Hurricane Fran in 1996 and was replaced at great expense and effort by the congregation.
Let's take it back a little bit earlier. This area was populated by indigenous peoples before European settlers arrived. Who were some of those people? Do we know?
Not very much. There was a tribe called the Cape Fear Indians who encountered Verrazano in 1522 and Captain Hilton when he was bumping around here around 1660 or so. They were not a very big tribe. Generally, they would come down to the coast during the summers and feast on clams and oysters and fish. Then apparently about the time hurricane season got started, they'd move inland, live in the woods, hunt deer. They had some simple simple agriculture going. Not too many of them, and they pretty much disappeared very early in the 1700s. There was a big Indian uprising called the Yamasee War, and the Moore family came up from who had found Brunswick Town came up from South Carolina and basically went Indian fighting, and there were not too many Cape Fear Indians left, and they were gone. And it's speculated that some of them might have moved into the swamps up in what's now Robeson County and become part of the Lumbee Nation, but we don't know that.
We've never been able to figure that out.
And then disease, I think, was another big factor,
right,
too. So the numbers all over the place, began to decline in all of the Indian tribes. But, that were the bones that were found at Thalian Hall, where supposedly this indigenous people, actually going back to before Columbus, because quite often they buried, if someone died, they would bury them on top of a hill.
The bones at Thalian Hall. I'm going to have to ask you more about that when we come back. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We have two crack historians in the house today, Tony Rivenbark and Ben Steelman. If you'd like to ask a question about local history or you'd like to share a quick family story and you're from this area, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. We'll take a short break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Coastline.